Hi, everyone. Thanks for joining us on The Week in Review. I'm Amanda Finicky. She says she's been underestimated at every turn. But in accepting Democrats' nomination for president right here in Chicago, Kamala Harris says she's ready to fight for America's future.
I see an America where we hold fast to the fearless belief that built our nation and inspired the world. That here, in this country, anything is possible. That nothing is out of reach.
Sharing her life story, promising a new path forward, and eviscerating her Republican opponent, Donald Trump. Illinois Democrats helped lead the charge.
Donald Trump thinks that we should trust him on the economy because he claims to be very rich. But take it from an actual billionaire. Trump is rich in only one thing, stupidity.
Harris also had unlikely help from Republicans. Former Illinois Congressman Adam Kinzinger says Trump has suffocated the GOP and is fraying democracy as we know it.
That day, I stood witness to a profound sorrow, the desecration of our sacred tradition of peaceful transition of power, tarnished by a man too fragile, too vain, and too weak to accept defeat. How can a party claim to be patriotic if it idolizes a man who tried to overthrow a free and fair election?
The DNC also brought star power to Chicago.
What about us? What about all the times you said you had the answer? What about us?
Despite trepidation, protests would create chaos and a brutal repeat of the past.
Good morning, everyone.
The mayor was able to sing the city's praises.
Executing the best political convention that this country has ever seen.
The balloons drop, the party's over, and the city's returning to normal. The historic race for the White House, though, will only intensify.
And all of us on our Week in Review panel will be covering it all. Joining us are the convention coverage team from WTTW. That's Nick Blumberg, Heather Sharon, and Joanna Hernandez. Also joining us to give his take on the convention is Daniel Knowles from The Economist. Thanks. You're an honorary WTTW member today. Yes. Thank you. We really appreciate your convention coverage. But I'm going to start, actually, with our very own Heather Sharon. This was a huge opportunity for Vice President Harris to, even though she's been vice president, really have to introduce herself. What did she have to do, and did she accomplish it?
Well, she had a very difficult task, right? Because the American people have not been paying attention to her as vice president. Her only job is to stand around and wait and make sure that Joe Biden, you know, keeps on ticking. But now she's asking for people's vote herself, and that is difficult as a woman. I'm sure Hillary Clinton, she talked a little bit about the scars that she suffered in 2016, and Kamala Harris did it differently than Clinton did in 2016. Her speech really leaned into sort of her ability to prosecute the case and to specifically to prosecute Donald Trump. We heard a lot about how she makes decisions guided by her late mother's sort of theories of sort of how people should treat each other. But she also said that she would not shy away from using force. She said that America should have the most lethal fighting force to protect democracy and to protect people's rights. That is not something you typically hear at a Democratic National Convention, which signals, I think, a new era for this party along with their new candidate.
Is that, Nick, because she is a woman and she has to sort of make that argument to speak to people who might be a little bit nervous about the notion of a woman as commander-in-chief, or is that a sign of the times?
I think it's a bit of both. I mean, I certainly think there's an element of Kamala Harris trying to bat away any of the stereotypes about is a woman going to be able to lead? Will she have the strength of a male president? All these sorts of tropes that were rolled out in 2016. And in 2012 and in 2008, I mean, this is not the first time we've been hearing these things. So I think she was addressing them without saying the name. You know, she wasn't saying, you know, as a woman, I can do this. She was saying, as a president, I can do this. And I also think it is a sign of the times in that we heard a lot in this convention, these sort of patriotic themes, the USA chants, the American flags. These are things that were, you know, largely political observers might expect more to see at the GOP convention. And I think the Democrats are in some way, you know, the Democrats and Kamala Harris as their standard bearer, kind of trying to reclaim the flag, reclaim patriotism. So I think it was a bit of both of those things.
Danielle, I want you to weigh in on that, because it is sort of fascinating to have watched first one party almost like co-opt the flag and the color red, and then it has been changing. Clearly, Democrats are using terms. It's not just chanting USA. Repeatedly, we heard freedom, freedom, freedom. Mm-hmm. What's going on?
I think this is something that, you know, they've lent into hard this time, but actually the Democratic Party is one of the most successful kind of center-left parties anywhere in the world. And one of the reasons why, I think, is that they've kind of always been able to lean very hard into, no, we're patriots too. You know, we're not like radical nationalists, we're not right-wingers, but we will wrap ourselves in the flag. And I remember 2020 and 2016 and, you know, every kind of election, the Democrats do this, and it's something that I think it's certainly in European countries the left often struggles with. So, yeah.
Interesting perspective there, Joanna. Mm-hmm. You know, we talked about the historic nature of Harris's presidency, in that she would be the first woman. She would also be the first Black and Asian woman to hold office, were she to win. She didn't really talk about that, though. What do you make of that? Is that something that you wanted to hear her make a more pointed case about, or?
I mean, we did hear her talk about her mother, right? That she talked about her mother a lot. But I did get a chance to talk to some people, and there's a lot of people backing her up, right? Especially we spoke to someone from the Jamaican consulate, and she talked about the fire that they have seen someone that looks like them, that represents them. So, yes, she didn't really talk a lot about her father. But the people that we spoke to, it seems like they're really trying to back her up, and they believe that seeing someone, a woman, someone with Jamaican descent, someone with South Asian blood, to represent them as a woman, to be there, it seems that they're excited.
You know, I cannot believe that it was just a month ago that President Joe Biden announced that he was dropping out. So, Heather, how much does Harris's campaign hinge on what Biden does now, his final months in office? She's tied to him. She's still the vice president.
She absolutely is. And it's going to be a very delicate two-step in the 76 days I think we have left, give or take. I've lost count at this point.
Fair enough.
So she has to sort of chart her own course while at the same time not undermine the sitting president, of course. And there are a lot of big issues on the national stage. I think the war in Gaza is probably right up at the top. And we heard her during the speech try to strike a delicate balance, calling for the hostages to be released, but also calling for an immediate ceasefire, and also sort of endorsing the right of the Palestinian people to live in safety and security. Now, that did not go anywhere close enough to where what Palestinian groups wanted to hear from her on stage, but it is a slightly different tone than President Biden, and so there's always a chance that the Republicans will be able to sort of lean into that breach and attempt to sort of, you know, press on that seam a little bit to exploit this issue. And that is going to be, I think, perhaps the biggest challenge for the vice president in the weeks to come.
Daniel.
I think that they're going to be all right on that. It was interesting. The tone is different, but actually the words are the same. American policy is back self-determination and freedom and dignity for Palestinians forever. And, you know, that there's an awful lot of like, oh, how did she say it, I think, in this. But, you know, that's a really tricky question, but I don't think there's huge divisions between Biden and Harris on Gaza. I think there's huge divisions between the American government and the Israeli government at this point, and particularly Benjamin Netanyahu, who seems like he would like Donald Trump to win. And so there's going to be tensions coming out of that. But I think in general, I didn't see that as being the big election
issue.
And I
do wonder, too, whether there's going to be an element, you know, irrespective of the issues, that this condensed time frame, a lot of folks are saying this could actually be an advantage for the campaign because they're not agonizing endlessly over these decisions. You know, sometimes journalists will joke that, like, we're better when we're on a tight deadline and you just need to turn something around quick as opposed to you've got 2 weeks to work on this piece and
less
you just sort of
time
like,
to stumble as well.
Absolutely.
And there's a lot of momentum. Undecided vote. I mean, let's talk about the people who are uncommitted delegates, right?
Yeah.
How they were trying to get a space to talk and they didn't get that chance. I mean, even the people that we spoke to out in the protest, Nick, you were out there as well. I mean, many of them wanted to hear from the Biden-Harris administration about, you know, end a ceasefire now. And it almost seemed like it was just talk. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if that's enough for them.
Yeah, you know, you said you don't think this is going to be an election issue in terms of how different the policy separates from Biden. But is it going to be an issue? Because you need every vote, particularly in battleground states. And for people for whom this is the number one issue, it wasn't enough
to
bring them aboard.
2% of the population by the polling, which it's significant, it's true. But I think that if the war really intensifies, if Netanyahu starts suddenly really bombing heavily again, we've got a trouble. But I think the fact is they are kind of pushing towards a ceasefire. Israeli politics has shifted. Israelis want a ceasefire and they want the hostages out. It depends what happens.
And there's so much else in terms of policy, of course, that is on many Americans' minds. The economy, number one. So, Nick, what do we hear from Harris in terms of that policy position that is first and foremost?
Absolutely. I mean, I think she spent a lot of time, and a lot of the surrogates as well, the other folks that we heard from, you know, making the case that your pocketbook will be better off. You know, I was at a meeting where Nancy Pelosi addressed the Women's Caucus of the DNC, and she said, we need to be campaigning, you know, not thinking about the boardroom table, thinking about the kitchen table, which is, you know, a pretty common political wisdom, but I think something that campaigns can sometimes lose sight of if they have these, you know, sort of lofty aspirations for what they want to be talking about, not that they shouldn't be speaking aspirationally, but the average American, the average voter, is relatively low information when it comes to the political class and when it comes to the positions that people have. They need to hear sort of clear, sharp messages about how will you make my life better? I'm worried about retirement. I'm worried about the cost of groceries and gas. I'm worried about sending my kids to college. And I think people tried to make the case particularly, you know, not even necessarily as much about what they will do, but contrasting what a Trump administration would be like. We heard a lot about
that.
That's
exactly right. We didn't hear a lot of sort of specific policies from Harris. This is what I will do. But she did say what Trump wants to do is bad. Mm-hmm. And that can be sometimes just as an effective tool. Now, Trump has proposed sort of a tariff on all goods coming into the country. We heard Harris say last night that that would essentially amount to a middle class tax increase. And she said she would cut taxes for the middle class. So that, of course, the devil is always in the details when it comes to tax policy. But something like that is something we're going to see her talk about a lot, especially because it helps make her other points where that she is going to paint Trump as an out of touch billionaire, not a happy billionaire like our own J.B. Pritzker. Well,
and I also think, too, contrasting Trump on the economic issues is likely to be more successful than this idea that he's a huge threat to democracy. Certainly, he has undermined and continues to, you know, lay out the ways in which he may undermine democratic norms. But I think a lot of folks aren't necessarily concerned about that. They don't necessarily think in terms of, I mean, certainly there's a significant portion of the population that does. But I think everyday voters also want to hear, like, why does gas cost so much money? And say, you know, why do all of these things that I'm buying cost so much money?
You know, Nick, certainly someone who is concerned about the notion of democracy and freedoms is former Illinois Congressman Adam Kinzinger, a Republican, I am going to stress, Republican on the stage at the Democratic National Convention. There were several of them. But Kinzinger said that democracy knows no party and then went on to call Trump a tyrant and an autocrat. Let's hear more from what Kinzinger had to say.
Donald Trump is a weak man pretending to be strong. He is a small man pretending to be big. He's a faithless man pretending to be righteous. Donald Trump has suffocated the soul of the Republican Party.
So, Daniel, is this a message that resonates with voters? Is it helping Harris, hurting Trump?
Yes. I think it's a really strong one. I think this idea that the voter doesn't care about the democracy stuff is completely wrong. I went to a polling presentation on Wednesday that was actually with Debbie Pritzker's chief of staff, but also this pollster from New York, and it was all about, I think it was partly about abortion rights, but one of the things that came out of it is that the average voter thinks that Donald Trump is very extreme. They think that, you know, they really hate this Project 2025 stuff. They kind of believe he wants to be a dictator. But where the Democrats have had this problem is essentially a sort of, can he actually do it? Essentially, the average voter thinks, yeah, Trump wants to be a dictator, but he won't be, really. He won't actually be able to do that, so they don't worry.
Too optimistic, almost.
Exactly. There's just a kind of sense of, yeah, he's not really going to be able to, you know, kind of throw out 10 million immigrants or whatever. So all these policies, they just think, oh, well, they won't really happen. And one thing that kind of put a crack in that was what happened to the Supreme Court, and particularly the Dodds decision, the changing of abortion rules all over the country. And so what this kind of argument was being made at this event I went to is, you know, if you hammer in Project 2025, this idea, which is this idea of, you know, Republican plan to kind of reshape the entire state, and then you say, they did it with abortion, this is what they want to do, that works as a message.
And that was that's the argument where we saw play out over and over, Heather.
Yeah, that's the argument that won the 2022 midterms for the Democrats, because it's one thing to say Donald Trump is an extremist who is going to undermine democracy. It's another thing to say Donald Trump's appointed Supreme Court justices stripped a constitutional right you ladies had for the last 50 years. It makes it more real to people.
And taking it from abortion to IVF, right, which is right, something that is less controversial for
many. Well, you know, and I think that the Democrats have argued it's not going to be just abortion. It might be gay marriage. It might be, you know, any number of things that we've seen sort of the Supreme Court sort of hack away at. You know, and I think we heard some about, you know, gun violence at the convention last night. You know, the Supreme Court has widened the sort of protections of the Second Amendment, and there's in fact a decision today that said the ban on machine gun sales is unconstitutional. Now, I don't know that there are very many sort of middle-of-the-road voters who wish that they had more machine guns walking around in their neighborhood. I may be mistaken on that. Who knows? But it's those sort of issues that you can really sort of viscerally sort of display for people. And this is why we heard Kamala Harris also talk a lot about her role as a prosecutor. She only had one client, she said, the people. And that is why her slogan, among others, is for the people. And it sort of is that sort of overall arching message that she has in a way that Joe Biden, I'm not sure, quite did.
And I was going to that effect, many of her policies are not that different than Biden.
No.
Again, repeat, she's, of course, his vice president. What are we saying that is this just more about the candidate? People were sick of Biden or what?
I think this election was going to go one of two ways. And last month, last time I was out here, the risk was that it was going to be a referendum on Joe Biden. Is he too old? And, you know, what we've seen for the whole time, Donald Trump is super unpopular. Even, you know, when I go out reporting him, they really don't like him. But they didn't really love Biden. They thought he was too old. They kind of wanted to step down. And a generic Democrat has been polling way better than Trump the entire time. And Kamala Harris has managed to become the generic Democrat. She's just, you know, she's not Trump.
She's not Trump and not Biden.
Not Biden.
You know, we heard a lot from prominent Chicagoans throughout the Democratic National Convention. I mean, Oprah, there was a local DJ spending tunes, any number of legislators, the former First Lady, Hillary Clinton, who, of course, has ties to the suburbs. Nick, what was the most memorable speech to you?
I think the one that really stood out to me, you know, to that point about people just a month ago being so sick of both choices, Michelle Obama opened up her speech by kind of asking the audience whether they'd been feeling the same sense of dread about the political scene that she had. And I think that's really interesting because, you know, before Biden dropped out, a lot of Democrats, or at least people who vote Democratic, were feeling really, really bad about his chances. They didn't want him to be the candidate, even if the, you know, sort of mainline Democratic officials weren't saying it openly. They were really, really feeling pretty despondent, a lot of folks that I've spoken with, that, you know, we've heard from. So I think that Michelle Obama openly addressing that sort of sense of dread and that ick in your stomach that people had been feeling but not publicly talking about, really caught my ear, and I thought it was, you know, rhetorically a very effective way then for her to sort of pivot and use that as saying, I'm feeling this new sense of hope. You know, the question is, did she stick the landing without taking too much of a dig at Joe Biden? And, you know, that's for Joe Biden to decide, I guess. But, you know, as a speech, it was, I thought it was really an interesting way to frame it.
So, Heather, Chicagoans may have watched those speeches on their televisions, but despite this being huge for the city to host and to carry off, for very few people really participated in it. So
that's right.
Give us a paint a picture for those who are curious. What am I not seeing on the television screen?
A lot of lines waiting to get past security checkpoints and a lot of sort of standing in line for food and bathrooms. It is a logistically hard thing to put on, right? Because there are thousands and thousands of people in a confined space. And everybody wants the selfie. Everybody wants to, you know, to sort of see the famous people. And it's hard. And I think that, you know, Chicago wanted to do two things. They wanted to sort of welcome all of the glittering political people so that they could see Chicago at its best. I was joking with Mayor Johnson that he needed to tell me sort of how he managed to get the weather to cooperate like this, because it is
that was magic.
Very
was,
rare yeah. to have a week where there is no humidity in Chicago in August. But, you know, the hope was is that people will see Chicago after years of Donald Trump and now J.D. Vance disparaging and denigrating Chicago and say, hey, you know what, that looks like a fun town to go to, and, of course, to bring their wallets. Mm-hmm. And spend some money here.
Yes, and so Joanna, I know you covered both the business aspect of things, but what I really want to talk to you is about, you also covered some of the protests, because that had been the fear, that Chicago might have a pretty skyline, and yet what about with this history of riots and police violence back to the 68 convention? What were the protests like?
Well, there was fear of disruption, right? But there really wasn't. For the most part, most of the organizers and the people who were there at a Union Park, they were mostly peaceful. I mean, there was families, there was people of all ages, people who came from Rockford, a mother that came here to join the protest. So it's not exactly what people thought it was going to be. I thought it was also really interesting how police was also really communicating with the protesters. Even the people who were standing up and talking in the rally, they were very adamant about following the rules. Really, their message was that they wanted to be heard. They've been protesting for 10 months.
Right, and the organizers themselves had marshals all along. Yes. Right, you know what I mean? It was.
So, Nick, can Chicago then shed the reputation of 68?
I certainly hope so, because I'm sick of hearing about it.
Larry Snelling just stood up and cheered, because he is very, very tired of hearing about 1968.
What does this mean for Chicago, I guess, is really broadly the answer then?
Well, I think it was a big test for the police department, which badly mishandled the 2020 protests and had to demonstrate not just to Chicagoans, but also to the federal judge in charge of reforming the police department, that it could constitutionally police protests like this. And 74 people were arrested. There were some injuries, none serious, but it couldn't have gone any better than from the police's perspective.
Which, of course, Daniel, Governor J.B. Pritzker had lobbied hard for the Democratic National Convention. What does how it went mean for him and his political future? You've been reporting heavily on that.
Yes. I mean, I think it's an interesting one, because I think he is absolutely in the ascendant in Illinois and, frankly, in Chicago at the moment. You know, he's been feuding with the mayor over what schools funding, you know, the Bears Stadium, all these things, and winning. And I was talking, you know, I was going to a lot of parties this week with kind of various sort of Illinois power brokers, you know, political people, and saying, well, there's one way where Johnson gets lots of credit for this convention, and if it's a disaster. And obviously it wasn't. JB was everywhere. But I think he was really hoping to pitch himself on a national stage, and I think it's a bit early to see whether he really did. You know, he was out on the Today Show.
The Daily Show, drinking Malort all over the place.
Taking Westmore to get a burger.
he had his primetime speech, or, you know, his kind of 5-6 minutes saying, I'm a jovial billionaire king, as it were. That's kind of what he was doing. He had beer.
That
he had
sounds
his own
really
brand
fun to be,
beer,
I'll be honest.
But I think he would love to be president. He would love to be giving that big speech. And he's not going to be doing that this time. He's kind of hope he's not going to be doing it in 4 years' time, because, you know, hopefully the Democrats win. But that's what his eye's on, and I think it's too early to see whether he really made progress on that.
So, Heather, we've got 30 seconds left. What is the state of the race? We have RFK dropping out, endorsing Trump. There's going to be so much more news in these months ahead. What is the state of the race?
Well, I think the next big date on the calendar is the debate. September 10th, it will be Trump versus Harris. I think a lot of people are going to be watching that debate to see how Harris handles Trump. And I think we will all have that contrast with Joe Biden fresh in our head. And I think it will give her a chance, if she's going to prosecute the case against Trump, no better chance for her to do it directly there.
Well, thank you so much. We will leave it there. Thanks to our Week in Review panel. Everyone here deserves not only sleep, but a shot of Malort, especially birthday boy Nick Lumberg and Heather Sharone, whose birthday was earlier this week. The best to you. Also, thanks to Joanna Hernandez and to Daniel Knowles. We will be back to wrap things up right after this.
Chicago Tonight is made possible in part by the Alexandra and John Nichols family, the Polk Brothers Foundation. Additional support is provided by
That is our show for this Friday night. Don't forget, you can get Chicago Tonight and the Week in Review streamed on Facebook, YouTube, and on our website, WTTW.com/news. Check it out. So much DNC content. You can get all of it. For the Week in Review, I'm Amanda Vinicky. Thanks for watching. Stay healthy and safe. Have a good night and a great weekend.
Okay, I just so happen to have this bottle of... No, not really.
I wish. I'm sorry. If I weren't so tired, I would have planned that. No,
actually,
Daniel, what to you is the state of the race?
No, no, no.
I think Kamala is the slight favorite now and needs to kind of keep building that, but it's also margin of error stuff. You know, we don't know.
They had the momentum, but it's holding on to it. Because coming out of the RNC, we talked... Republicans felt like they had a lock.
Events happen, so there's you know, it may feel very short by American presidential elections, but 2 months is still a good amount of time. Stuff could happen, but I think she's got the momentum.
Short.
Maybe that would be the winning message.
Yeah, right. Let's just do this again sometime. Uh-huh, because I think it does help the candidate. I think it keeps people engaged.
Closed captioning is made possible by Robert A. Clifford and Clifford Law Offices, a Chicago personal injury and wrongful death firm that is proud to recognize its founder and senior partner, Robert Clifford, who ranked number one in the state of Illinois by Super Lawyers Top 10 2024 Illinois Super Lawyers List.